Today on the Kickback FC, he's a former U.S. men's national team midfielder who played nearly 200 MLS games across DC United and New England Revolution, earned a national team call-up, and helped DC United win multiple supporter shields and a U.S. Open Cup. In 2024, he was inducted into the North Carolina Soccer Hall of Fame, MLS legend Clyde Sims.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Kickback FC. Appreciate you guys tuning in to our YouTube channel. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
So welcome back to the Kickback FC, your go-to spot for unfiltered, real talk, all things soccer. We're breaking down the biggest moments, hottest takes, and everything you need to know to stay plugged into the world's game. We'll even tap into other sports from time to time because if it's big in sports, we got some thoughts on it. So whether this is your first episode with us or you've been rocking with us from the beginning, just want to say thank you again to all of our friends and supporters. Once again, my name is Cornelius. I'm joined by my boys and fellow co-hosts. Mike, how you feeling tonight?
I'm feeling great, man. We have a real proper MLS legend on, you know, so I'm feeling pretty good. How about you, Gabriel?
I feel good, man. It's been a jam-packed day. Always good to talk with the guys, but like you, Mike said, you know, very excited to talk to our guest. Cornelius, how you feeling?
Good, man. It's been a long day, like you said, but it's been a footy-filled day, so I'm not even mad at it. Salam, how about you?
Feeling good, man. Excited to be here with you guys and our guests as well, too. So I'll get into it, man. Today on the Kickback FC, he's a former U.S. men's national team midfielder who played nearly 200 MLS games across DC United and New England Revolution. He got his start with the Richmond Kickers, earned a national team call-up, and helped DC United win multiple supporter shields and a U.S. Open Cup. In 2024, he was inducted into the North Carolina Soccer Hall of Fame. MLS legend, Clyde Sims. Appreciate you pulling up to the Kickback, man. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. No, appreciate your time. So, like all our guests, man, kind of just want to get into the origin story, kind of want to get into the beginning of your footy career. What made you fall in love with the game, you know, growing up in Jamestown, North Carolina? Kind of explain what the landscape of soccer was in the 90s and 2000s. You know, we're from Ohio, so we kind of know what it was like growing up here. But being born in the 90s, I was kind of starting to watch TV when you were getting into, you know, your real playing days. So what was soccer like growing up in North Carolina and, you know, leading out of high school? What were prospects like, you know, looking at going into college or maybe going pro for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, soccer, my parents grew up in North Carolina. And so I was born and raised there. And that's where we grew up. And so they didn't have soccer growing up in school. And they knew nothing about it. My dad was basketball and baseball. But he loved basketball. Obviously, as soon as signups were available for basketball, he had me in it. So he signed me up for basketball, but it was he signed me up early, and we had the fall to get to, you know, the winter to basketball season. He wanted me to have something to do until that time, and so he signed me up for soccer. And so I played, and I ended up, in his words, just you know, a natural. Basically, as far as I can remember, I loved it. And I played both soccer and basketball all the way through my junior year in high school. I loved both sports. And matter of fact, there was a time where I almost stopped playing soccer to pursue basketball, but then quickly realized that I wasn't gonna be that tall. I think I'm like 5'9" and a half. And then I gravitated. I got a little older. I definitely gravitated towards soccer. You know, I had this conversation and we can joke about it now. It was a time where it was a little sensitive for my dad to hear, but because he didn't know soccer at all, he would, when it came to a soccer game or practice or whatever, he was just there to support. That was it. He didn't know what to say. He didn't know what feedback to give me. He just, you know, saw I was succeeding and he was just there. But when it came to basketball, every on the way to the game, during the game, after the game, yeah, I could hear him the whole time. And you know, to his defense, I was really good at basketball as well. I think that's why I gravitated towards soccer. I felt free playing soccer. Growing up in North Carolina, there weren't many of us. Every team that I played on, I was the only African American to be on the team. And like, I think, you know, even in other teams, you know, when I got a little older, it got to the point where there was like one more on the other team, you know. But it's funny, every level that I went up, you know, I played with more and more Blacks, and which was really cool because we all had the same story. We were the only Black on the team, and growing up, it was just, you know, a bit difficult for us when it came to certain things off the field. But soccer, we were in North Carolina. It was good. Like, it's one of those things you don't know, you know, really how good you are until you start playing teams from other states and different tournaments. And we ended up, my team won state cup, and I feel like we got lucky that first year when we won it. But then we were kind of right in the middle of the state in Greensboro, or right outside of Greensboro, Jamestown. And after that year we won, it was like everyone, all the good players from other teams just started coming to our team. And so we won every year after that. I think we won state cup 8 years in a row, something like that. Jeez. Back then it was awesome. I get so confused with the youth landscape these days. I'm up here in Massachusetts, and I train kids on the side, and just listening to the different leagues. And, you know, you got so many kids traveling down to New Jersey every other weekend to play teams. They're in the same league. I just don't understand it. But back then, everything was connected. Like, you played your teams in North Carolina against them. If you won state cup, you went to regionals. If you won regionals, you went to nationals. And we won state cup 8 years in a row, so we went to a few different regionals. We won regionals 1 year. But back then, you only went to nationals. I think it was on odd years. So you went every other year. Yeah. You go to nationals. So we won regionals, but it was an off year, so we didn't get to go to nationals at the time. And unfortunately, but yeah, we ended up just having this like team that did really, really well growing up. All of us went to the same high school. It was crazy. Same school all the way growing up. So our high school team was really good as well. One thing I took for granted down there was being able to play year round outside. I'm in Massachusetts now, so it's like there's times of the year where no chance we went out there. How nice the grass was down in North Carolina is like took that for granted as well. But looking back, I was very fortunate, you know, being a soccer player to grow up in North Carolina. You know, the support we had, the facilities that we had, it was great. It was great. Yeah, I loved it.
No, that's great. It's cool hearing that, you know, everything was kind of like localized. You know, like you said, nowadays you might be in a club that practices an hour away. You know, you might be in the same state, but have, you know, practice an hour away, and then games are 2 hours away. I feel like back then everything was a little bit more centralized, which is cool. You went to you played on the same club team as your high school buddies, and that just makes the camaraderie even a lot better. That's probably why you guys won 8 state cups in a row, because you guys knew each other like the back of your hand. You know, that's kind of cool to hear.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we were fortunate. And like coming through, I played club, the same club. I was young for my grade. So I was younger than everyone else. And so when I first started playing club, I had to, when my parents wanted me to start, I had to play 2 years up. And then after that first year, I moved down one age group to the next. And so I played all the way through my junior year, 1 year up for my age. So and then the team kind of fell apart going into our senior year. So I was able to play with my age group, and I would drive to Charlotte three times a week for training and games. And it was great. Played for Charlotte Soccer Club back then. And we had a great team. And I started getting, obviously, a lot of looks from colleges, universities. I got a lot of letters from some top schools, but that was about it. No calls or anything like that back then. I got, but I ended up going to East Carolina University. Mm-hmm. Yep. They don't have a men's program anymore, but they had just started it back the year before I ended up going to ECU. And I just got, there's a couple of factors. I tell everyone my visit was just a blast. So I think that's what ultimately got me there. But I made friends with other guys that were on the same visit. my roommate and one of my good friends to this day, we were roommates all the way through college, Brian Deutsch. And, you know, we kind of called each other after that visit, and the coach was great back then. And he was on top of things. He was calling, like, he made me feel like, you know, I was going there to, you know, be one of his guys. And you know, he really confided in me and my talent. So that's another reason why I went to ECU. But yeah, after that visit, I got in touch with Brian, and he was like, I'll go if you go. And I was like, I'll go if you go. So, we committed. And yeah, I loved it. We weren't very good at East Carolina.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit, because yeah, you know, you go from having a lot of team success to you know, going to Eastern Carolina and everything not being so, you know, so the same. So how did that, you know, affect you being a college player? Because you probably had aspirations like, oh, okay, I'm going to college, like, mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. the team wants me. You probably have aspirations of playing, you know, at the next level after college. How did that 4 years in college kind of affect your mindset at the time, and what was your mindset?
Yeah, so my mindset at the time, I was kind of, I didn't look too far ahead to professional. Okay. I mean, growing up, you know, MLS started back in, what, 96, first year? Or yeah, I think. And so before that, all I would watch is the Premier League on Fox Soccer. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Oh, and Fox Soccer Plus. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They play like a couple games a week. That was it. And you might catch a replay here and there, but if nothing else was on. And I just fell in love with it, you know, watching EPL. But at no point I thought that I was going to be able to play, you know, over there, because MLS didn't exist when I was growing up.
Right.
And so MLS was starting to take fold. And then when I went to school in 2000, so MLS was only a few years old.
Oh, wow.
when I went to school. And so I still didn't really think too much about playing in MLS or playing pro at all. I was gonna, you know, I got a scholarship full ride to go play at ECU, and I was studying construction management. And that, to me, that was what, you know, that was my fate. I was gonna, you know, I was able to use soccer to get a good education and into a field that I was interested in and could be successful at after soccer and provide for myself and my family. And that's what I was planning to do. And then I had some good seasons. I made some like all-conference teams. It was tough with our team for anyone to get really any, you know, big accolades, because we just didn't win enough games. It was one of those situations as a group. And so my coach at the time, Michael Benn, he thought I could play the next level. So I just let him do his thing. I was like, if you think so, we'll try it out. So we applied for the MLS Combine at the time, and we were just waiting to hear back, and we didn't hear anything. We didn't even hear no, not selected or anything. Next thing you know, the Combine was happening, and obviously didn't hear, so I didn't get invited to it. And then he was like, okay, I got this. Richmond Kickers were at the time the closest team to where I was in Greenville, North Carolina. Probably about 3.5 hours up the road. And he contacted them. They had an invitational tryout coming out. So the coach at the time, Lee Kalishaw, he invited me in, and I just drove up there myself, had my stuff with me. I had to get my own hotel room and everything. I think that was the first time I had ever done that on my own, which was an experience in itself. And I went to the tryout, and on day two, Lee pulls me to the side, and he's like, if I can get you a contract that makes sense for you, would you come play? And at the time, my major in school was construction management, and it was so small that it took me four and a half years to graduate, because there would be a semester where maybe the class that I needed was only offered once, and it was during practice time. So I had to push it off to the next semester, and I had to do that a couple of times. So it took me 4.5 years to graduate. And so in between, when I was done with my eligibility, that summer, that's when I played my first season with the Kickers. And I told Lee, I said, if I can do what I need to do to finish up the semester on the front end of the season and then go back early to start the next semester, then I'll do it. And Lee said, okay, we can work with that. So I'd be driving up at the end of my semester, season had already started, for the games coming back and then going back to school that week. And then my semester would end, and then I was full time with the team. And then at the end of the season, same thing. I was going back to school to start up, and then I'd come back for games and playoffs. And so that's how I did my first year. My first contract was like $250 a month, base. That was it. Yeah. Base. And then I got bonuses if I – and we had to negotiate the bonuses. But I got bonuses if I dressed and then if I got in the game or if I started. And I had a good season, and I ended up starting a lot of games. And you know, for a college kid, I mean, I think I got $150 if I started. So to me, that was like
walking around.
Yeah. And we had the games so frequently, you know, during the summer and USL. I mean, it was the A League back then, and it was kind of jam packed, all in like summer months. That was it. Long season.
Before I pass, I kind of wanted to ask about that because. It's kind of crazy, like, you know, up being from Ohio, our home team, you know, growing up was the Columbus Crew, and you see the 1996 on the jerseys, but you're putting it into perspective, like, you're graduating college, and the MLS is still new. What was the A-League like? You know, there's no USL yet. US soccer is kind of reinventing itself, so kind of explain, you know, the landscape of the A-League. Like, obviously, yeah. This tryout at Richmond, but, you know, what's the play like, you know?
Yeah.
Getting paid $250 stipend, pretty much. What's, you know, you're kind of still one foot in school, one foot, you know, out of school. So what's the game like? How are you feeling? You know, are you like, can I go pro, or is this just another stepping stone?
So in my position, and, you know, Richmond, we were good. We had some great vets, and the A-League back then was a mix of guys still holding on and then young guys. That was it. It wasn't much in between. It was like it was guys that just loved the game so much, the older guys, and they were just staying with it as long as they could. And then there were guys that had ambitions of you know, playing pro, and they were coming in. But it's like, the guys in between had already made that decision, like, let me go ahead and hang it up type. So that was kind of the A-League. And my position, like, I could run, you know, I ran all day. And when I was young, I was pretty quick. And so I had a lot of success, you know, in there, because you're playing against a lot of vets, some guys that played MLS and were done with MLS and coming back down, and they just couldn't move the same. But Richmond, we had a good mix. And we had a really good team. My first year, we played DC United in Open Cup, and it was the year they won the championship. But they had a wild season where they just weren't that great, and then all of a sudden they just got hot, and then they just ended up going all the way through. But during that those moments where they weren't that great, and I think it was Freddie Adu's first season, they came to Richmond to play us in Open Cup, and we beat them. I think it was 2-1, I believe. And I had a decent game. I was lively, and you know, I was comfortable. Had a couple chances in the game, and it went well. Then we played Chicago the next game, and lost that one. But so we had a good team in Richmond, and it was actually a couple of guys that had just come from MLS, and we had a really good rookie squad, and so I enjoyed the A-League. You know, it was fun. At that time, I was, especially when I was young, I just felt, you know, you obviously have so much more energy when you're young. And like, I was just getting better and better at that time. And I was gaining confidence like every single week. And it was pretty wild. And then from there, everything happened really, really fast. After my first season, I signed a 2-year contract. And I was going to go back, finish school that last semester and come back. I'd already talked to my buddy, Tim Brown, who ended up having a great career. And we were going to be roommates. We were excited about it. I was at the movies one night back at school. And I come out of the theater, and my phone had, like, blown up. I never experienced anything like this. I had so many missed calls from, like, coaches. And my coaches in Richmond. And then the coaches of, it was actually the national team, U.S. national team. So, and this was the off season. So, like, I hadn't really been doing anything. I was just about to start, like, the next week or so to start going out on the field to get in shape for the next season. The national team went on strike.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they went on strike, and they had a they had a World Cup qualifier coming up against Trinidad and Tobago, and they had to play it. It was a World Cup qualifier, but none of the guys would come in. None of the European guys, none of the MLS guys would come in. So we were like the next best thing. So they called in A-League players to come and train and potentially play the game. So we had three weeks before the game. And so my phone had blown up from the first person I called was my assistant coach in Richmond. That's the first person I called back because he had called the most. And he's like, you know what's going on right now? And I said, no. And he's like, the Bruce Arena's calling you into camp. And I'm like, what? He explained it to me, and I still didn't really know what was going on at the time. And the next thing I know, a couple of days later, I was in LA meeting up with, and we had a really good season the season before with Richmond. So it was a good amount of us from that team, a good amount from a couple other teams. And so I had some buddies there, and we were all it was just wild. It was wild. We were training with the national team and then potentially playing a World Cup qualifier with the U.S. men's national team. So the Federation wasn't gonna let that happen, I feel like, and so let us play the game. So we trained for a good week, I feel like, a good week. And most of the guys were out of shape because it was our off season, and our season was so short before that, so it wasn't like we were even coming off season. And so I had a really good few days of training. I think we had a day off the next day. And some of us went out to get food from the Richmond team, and we're out at dinner. And one of the guys' wife calls him and gives him the news that the strike ended. They came to terms and everything was over. So then he broke the news to everyone at the table. And then we started getting calls from Bruce's staff that, you know, everything had ended. We're going to meet at first thing in the morning. And so the guys were, they got a couple of beers and were cheers and, for the experience that we were able to have, because it was an experience, you know. It was the first time a lot of us had just had the, even the care taken of us. Yeah, it was an experience. We had to, back in Richmond, we had to wash our own jerseys in between trainings and stuff like that. We had to take it home with us. Yeah. If we needed treatment, we had to go to a whole nother facility and then go to train wherever training was. Training was in different places. But with the national team, it was an experience. And that was the first time a lot of us experienced that. And so, we cheers. We had a good time that night. And right after we got that news, Glenn Myernick, he was assistant at the time, he calls me. And he said, have you heard the news? And I said, yeah, I just found out. And he's like, well, what do you have planned the next couple of weeks? And I was like, I was planning on being here. So I don't have any plans. And he's
real.
Yeah. And he said, okay, well, we want to keep you here. And so I thought a few guys were, you know, we were getting in shape, and at this point they only had like 2 weeks till the game. So maybe they're keeping a few guys that they were impressed by. They were going to help out. And so we had the meeting the next day. Bruce breaks the news to us. They give us a bunch of gear as a thank you. And then Bruce makes an announcement. And he's like, we decided to keep one player here, Clyde Sims. And everyone's, clapping and stuff. And I was the only one that they kept. And I thought they were keeping a group of us, but it was just me. And at the time,
Just 1 second. Just run me through that, because you – One, it's Bruce Arena. This is a guy that we all known and knownly respect. But, you know, you're in this camp. You're thinking, you know, I potentially say it's not confirmed. But then when it gets confirmed, kind of just run me through, you know, what was your thought? Because at that time, if I'm not mistaken, this is the Clint Dempsey's a part of this squad. You know, this is kind of a star-studded U.S. men's national team at that time. What did it mean to you, you know, just having that honor to say – To just know that, hey, not only does Bruce Arena, but his entire staff wants me to stay and to be a part, maybe not potentially, you didn't travel at that time, but they want me to be a part of this USMS national team squad. Mm-hmm. What did that mean for you?
Yeah, so this was 2005, and this was January camp 2005. So Clint and Eddie, Mike McGee, Chad Marshall, we were all like the youngest. We were all the same age. So we were the young crew that kind of stuck together and hung out. And then we're talking about Eddie Pope. We're talking about Clint Mathis.
Like Gucci on Yewu, was he there?
Gucci was there. I had a second camp. That's when I got my cap, and I was roommates with Gucci. But that was later in the year. But this camp, I mean, it was wild. Like, so the craziest part was I was already there, right? So then now the strike is ended, and now guys are just funneling in, right?
Like, seeing everybody.
But we had a good 2 days where it's just me, Bruce, and the staff, and that was it. I was just kind of hanging out, waiting. I did a little bit of working out until everyone got there, and then guys just start coming in, and these are guys that I at that point were watching, the beginnings of MLS, and I was watching. So Eddie Pope and I went to the same high school, and so I always followed his career. So I grew up basically watching DC, and they had some great years in the beginning. And so they were always on TV in the playoffs and stuff like that, MLS Cup. And so, yeah, he walks in, and it was wild. And it was the team. And so now I'm there, and we start training, so that's happening, right? But now, off the field and outside of training, now it's become news that they kept this kid that was playing A-League. And so now I got agents contacting me for them to be, wanting to be my agent. I had like three or four options. And now I had, there's news coming out that teams were trying to get my rights from Richmond. And so I confided in Ben Olsen at the time. And because I was having a good camp, I don't know what it was, but like I at the time I like belonged. It was wild. I mean, I had been there for a week and gotten some of those guys were in their off season as well. So, I was lively. I was excited. I had a lot of energy.
Did you see a big difference when you were playing for the Richmond Kickers compared to, like, what was that transition like? Because we've spoken to a good amount of professionals, and they always talk about that transition from high school to college, right? It's always usually a big transition, but then that transition from college to the pros is also that big step. I feel like the national team is, another step for you, only having, that 1 year at Richmond. Kind of walk me through, what was that transition like for you, and what was, what were the levels at that point? Did you feel like, you felt like you belonged, but, what were those differences that you saw in your play compared to the guys who had been playing in the MLS for, a couple of years and had been on the national team?
Yeah, definitely speed of play. Every level, I train kids now, and I tell them all, I'm like, look, every level you go up, you're going to tell yourself, like, these players aren't that great. I can do this. I can hang, but I tell them all, like, cause the biggest difference is consistency. So like they're putting the ball on the money 10 times out of 10 or 9 times out of 10. They're doing everything in two touch versus, versus three, or one touch versus three. The movement off the ball, but everything at the end of the day, everything's simple. It's just it's so different up here and down. The technical ability is just so consistent. It's so consistent, and that is the biggest difference for every level. I mean, when I played for DC, we were fortunate enough to play. We played Real Madrid twice. We played and good teams. We played Galacticos, and we played when Cristiano had just gotten there, and Gareth and Kaká and all of them were on that team, Xavi Alonso, and playing against these guys. And we played when Chelsea in 2005, we played Chelsea, and that's when Jose had just taken over. They were unbelievable. And we got to play against these teams, and like even when you play those teams, like a lot of them, they're athletic. A lot of them are bigger, a bit stronger. maybe some of them are a little quicker, but a lot of them aren't really, but they're just so technically sound, and like they just do everything with ease, and they know where to be. You know, those teams, they're like, the way they move together is, we played Ajax 1 year, and like, we just could not, we watched them in training, and all they did was pattern play. That's all they did for like an hour and 15 minutes, nonstop. And they had, one guy would have the ball, they'd have two options. So if this option isn't open, this is where you go. If the ball goes here, these two options, and we'd watch it, and they'd do the same patterns for an hour and 15 minutes. We knew exactly what they were trying to achieve. We still couldn't stop it. And like, that's the difference. I'm a firm believer that a lot of MLS guys, given the right opportunity, and once you get into that atmosphere, your game will just rise. Because the thing about good players is they make other players good as well. They make it easier.
Yeah.
So when I'm in that training, they're hitting me a ball that I can play one touch to the next guy, you know, whereas at lower levels, you might be getting a ball that's not the right weight. Yeah, it's not the right weight, or, you know, something breaks down. But, you know, so it was great. It was an awesome experience. And then from that camp, by the time I left that camp, I was on DC United. Everything just happened so fast. And I got an agent, and then DC got my rights. So then I went back to school after camp. I didn't make the 18. I almost made the 18 to go to travel, because there was only two D men. There was only one D mid, Pablo Mascherini, at the time. He was the only healthy D mid, and so Bruce was going to take me. But then they decided to not, because they were doing some other things, and they were just going to slide in Clint in that position if they needed to. So I went back to school, and I think I had like a day or two to get all my stuff. And then I flew to Hawaii for preseason with DC United. So then just like that, I was in preseason with DC. And then from then on out, I was MLS player. It was a wild, wild time.
I just want to say that I think that's one of the most unique stories. On, you talk about going from college to the pros. I mean, I don't know how many people have gone. You were playing A-League at the time. Obviously, the strike was going on. Nobody could have foreseen that, but you got your opportunity to go there because of that. Your performances kept you there, and then you get signed to, I mean, not only do you play for the national team, but you then get signed to an MLS team. I think that's such a crazy story. But when you said Eddie earlier, right? I know, because it was you, Clint Dempsey, Mike McGee, it's Eddie Johnson, right?
Yeah, Eddie Johnson. But Eddie Pope was there as well. Yeah.
Eddie Pope was there too.
Yep.
Yeah, you guys, man. Yeah, you, Clint, and Eddie Johnson. I was like, oh, man.
Yeah.
You got something here, guys.
we got to play the first year of TST. I played on Clint's team, and Eddie was on the team as well. Eddie and I pulled a hamstring in the first 5 minutes. Done the whole time. But those guys are great. And we were all kind of, you know, Clint and Eddie had been in the league at the time, and they were having some real success.
Yeah.
But we were all kind of in the same boat, and it was really cool. Really cool experience. So when we left, let's see. Oh, no. So there was an okay. So I went and played for DC. We played a 3-5-2, and I was D mid, and I ended up being like the third D mid. We had Ben Olsen, and then we had Brian Carroll. And DC had just won the championship the year before, and so I just wasn't breaking the lineup. But anytime one of them were out, I would get in, and I feel like I played almost every game in some capacity. I get slide in at like outside mid at the time, and they try me in different positions. But we were the three, Ben, BC, and myself, and we were good. And so at the time, we lost in the semis, semifinal to, or the Eastern Conference final to New England at the time. But that season, we had a reserve league. I don't know if you guys remember the reserve league. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't play, if you played a certain amount of minutes, you couldn't play in a reserve league game the next morning. We played on Sunday morning. But mm-hmm. if you didn't play that amount or you didn't dress, you were eligible for the reserve league match. So it was a good mix. Like, you'd have guys coming back from injury, regular starters getting minutes, and you'd have decent players that just didn't get into the game the night before, so they would end up in reserve league. I think we almost went undefeated that year in reserve league. And so Bruce at the time was living in D.C. Kenny Arena was on the team. And Kenny and I and our buddy Jamil Walker, we lived out in the sticks. We were like a good 45 minutes from D.C., from RFK, like over an hour with traffic in the mornings. So we carpooled. And so every other morning we switch out who was driving. But like three times a week, I was going to Bruce's house, pick up Kenny. And we would drive into town. Bruce would... Kenny nor Jamil and I were like regular starters, so we were always playing in the reserve league games on Sunday. Bruce started coming to the reserve league games, and it was kind of early in the season, and Bruce called me into the national team again. And I wasn't even starting for DC. And so now Peter at the time, he had to start me the next two games. Because how are you going to have
him called up?
Yeah.
You got to play now.
Wait, so this was World Cup qualifiers and a game against England. So I got called up. And so Peter started me. And we won both games. And I had great games. Then I go into camp. And this is when I was rooming with Gooch, and like this is all like European players and MLS players. And our first game, we had a tune-up game against England in Chicago, and I got in at the end of that game. That was my one and only cap. But we had two games after that, one against Costa Rica and Salt Lake, and then we played Panama in Panama. For World Cup qualifiers for the 2006 World Cup. And I made the 18 for both games. Didn't get into Costa Rica, and then Panama game, which was a wild experience, but they're about to put my number up, and DeMarcus pulls up like a hamstring or something like that, or his calves are cramping or something like that. And then we had to make a different change. I had my jersey on. Yep. So I didn't get to get in that game, but we're flying back that night, and Bruce is going around, and he tells me, Clint and I were playing cards, sitting beside each other, and he's like, Clint, Clyde, I'm bringing you into the Gold Cup. He's going around telling everyone that's coming to the Gold Cup and who's not. And I'm pumped at this point. It's like, because the World Cup is next year. Yeah. And so I'm like, man, what if, you know? And so we go back, and I go back to DC, and I'm not starting. And not only am I not starting, but we won the two games that I played in right before I left, and we didn't win a game while I was gone. We drew three games, I think, two or three games. Jeez. And I wasn't starting. I later get an email from Bruce, because he's about to call, name the team. And he's like, I want you to establish yourself with DC, so I'm not going to bring you into the Gold Cup. I believe they won it that year too, but didn't get to go in. And at that time, I was obviously frustrated, but it fueled me. Like at that point, like I was like, yeah, I was just I was so focused, and like I was getting better and better every game. Ben Olsen ended up going to the to the World Cup that year in 2006. And so when Ben left, again, it was the three of us, Brian Carroll, myself, and Ben. Ben left, now I'm starting.
Yeah.
And this is 2006. We didn't lose one game. We didn't lose one game. We won Supporter Show that year, but we didn't lose one game before All-Star break. We lost the game. We lost the one game before it. Sorry, the one game before All-Star break. That was our first loss of the season. And Ben is gone. Ben comes back, and we still don't lose. We just keep winning. We won supporter shield so early that season. It was wild. I mean, it's probably a record. And the first game we lose, I got taken out of the lineup, and Ben got. When Ben came back, it was probably like five or six games where Peter was like, just rest. He just kept telling Ben to rest because we just kept winning. And then the first game we lost, I got taken out of the lineup, 2006. Yeah. 2007, we got a new coach, and then that's the year I became like a regular starter, 2007. And I had a great career at DC. I really enjoyed my time there. Called that home for 7 years and made a ton of friends. Both my sisters used to come visit all the time, and they both live there now in DC. Yeah. That's how we're expanding and revved out there. And then the end of my career, we got to a point where like everything, and they say 7 years, like at any job is like a long time. And typically when change happens, and after my seventh season, it was just time to see something else. Cause at the time I wanted to coach, be a coach. And, I needed to see different philosophies. And I also just didn't really believe in what we were doing in DC at the time. And so I went into the reentry draft and got picked up by New England, And, this was in 2012 before the 2012 season. And, came up here. It was Jay Heaps's first season as a head coach. Okay. And we had some decent players. I mean, Shawri and I were playing in the middle together, Shawri Joseph. And then we had Benny Philhaber. We had Lee Wynn in the midfield as well. We had some decent players. We couldn't really get it together that first season, but second season, we had a much better season. We made the playoffs, and we came close to upsetting Sporting KC. We hit like, it was with the aggregate and stuff. It was, we came super close and lost. And then after that, it was just, I talk about it more now, but I was born with a rare kidney disease. And so I had it my whole career. So probably from the start of playing with DC, my kidney function at most was like 60%. Yeah, 60%, and it would fluctuate. It was wild because I'd have to take painkillers at times. I mean, there was times we took Toradol to be able to play.
Jeez, and that's when not I good for your kidneys either.
It wasn't great at all. And whenever I took Toradol, I'd go to the doctor to check it out, and my kidney function would drop a lot. And then as time would go on, it would come back up. Looking back, so thankful something bad didn't happen. But when you're in it, like, what's that?
You can only three think about football and, being as fast back possible. You know, I want to be on the pitch. I want to be starting. Cause I mean, you know, you spoke about it, you know, you would get called up and then you go back to DC and then no playing time. And then it's like, oh, I finally got my opportunity and I'm starting regularly. And it's like, I don't want this to get taken from me. So that, for that to happen is, I could only imagine you want to get back as quickly as possible. Right before I definitely want to talk, about, just your journey, through dealing with, the kidney disease and things like that. But just before we get to that, I definitely want to talk just a little bit about DC before we get off, at DC. And, to us, I'm the youngest out of our group. Freddie Adu was one of like, I mean, to the U.S., he was like everything. One of the youngest, just phenomenons in U.S. football, if I'm being completely honest. Kind of walk me through kind of just what it was, playing with him and kind of dealing with, all the media attention that he also brought during that time as well. Because I can only imagine, what all that entailed, especially for him at such a young age.
Yeah, it was Freddie was, he was like that. I mean, it was the media that we got at that time when we traveled, we brought crowds because of Freddie. The crowd would be much larger than normally would be at any place really, because Freddie was there. And Freddie was like, I think he's the only player that I can say that I played with and trained with every day, that every single day he would do something that I'd be like, he's unreal. Like every day he do at least one thing that I just shake my head at. He really was like that at the time. And Freddie and Peter, the coach later came back and explained to me that when I came back from the national team, he didn't want me to have too much too soon because he didn't think it was going to be good for my development. And he treated Freddie the exact same way. Peter and I, I was much older than Freddie at the time. And it was more frustrating for me. But for Freddie, I think Peter did a great job with Freddie, to be honest with you. I know everyone wanted to see him play more. Everyone wanted him on the field more, but I really do think that Peter was doing a good job with Freddie, managing his minutes, helping just to manage all of this stuff to really ensure that he was going to be a long-term success. And Freddie just didn't like that. And Freddie's got everyone in his ear telling him he needs to move to play more. And it was really unfortunate because Freddie did move on. It came to a time where it was just too much. It was too distracting at the time. And Freddie went to Salt Lake and he got everything. So he got all the playing time. He was the man, because back in DC, we had Aleko Eskandarian. We had Jaime Moreno. So I think who else we had, and Freddie wasn't really touching them at that time as far as to be able to start over them. Eski had just scored two goals in the 2004 MLS Cup to win, so he wasn't coming off. And Jaime at the time was just about to or taking over for the lead, most goals in MLS, leading goal scorer in MLS. So Freddie was a little bit unfortunate there. When he went to Salt Lake, he got everything. And then we kind of saw what started to happen in Freddie's career, from there. But like, he was the real deal. He was. And I thought Peter was doing the right thing for him, even though it wasn't what he wanted at the time. But Peter had been through that. Peter was a great player. Peter was a great manager, I think, at DC. I know things are a bit different for him in Philly, but in DC, I tell everyone, he had that whole locker room wanting to run through a wall. And that is the older I got, the more I realized how rare that is to be able to manage guys, especially guys that are getting paid. And we weren't getting paid a ton. Some guys were getting paid a lot of money and, the egos and stuff like that. But Peter, he had our respect. And he had us going. It's so much that even the year, so he left in after 2006 to go to move on, and even in 2007, that same team, we kept that mentality, and I think we won that sports show in 2007 off of what we were under Peter in 2006.
That's amazing. And it kind of brings me, before I pass it off to and Mike, it really brings me to another question I actually just thought about, because in nowadays game, right, we see the emergence of a lot of young players, right? A lot of I'm a big Arsenal fan, so Bukayo Saka got his introduction to the first team very early on. You can talk about Lamine Yamal, who is he's of course the star that we know of today. You can talk about Max Dalman, another guy, Dorgu, Mainu, the list goes on, right? With speaking about Freddie and how, when he got everything, things kind of started to dwindle a little bit. What would be, I guess, your perspective on, the young players that are getting these opportunities so early? Are you for, protecting them and wanting to, kind of shield them and not give them all that spotlight that early? Or are you more on the side of, if you're that good and you're out competing and doing better than the guy in front of you, that you should get that spotlight? Because, it's kind of a two-sided coin. You can either go really, really well for that player in that situation, or, it can go on the other side. So kind of just, run me through your mindset, kind of, you know, what's your perspective on that? Because it's very interesting for you to expect you to see it, you know, in real time. It's very
No, that's a great question. I think everyone's different, right? Yeah. I do. Mm-hmm. And I think, but it takes a special person to be able to continue to push yourself. Because we, you know, these, it's like a lot of these kids didn't spend that much time with pro aspirations. Like they became pro so early on, you know? It's like, I think that most of them, they have to be managed. They have to be managed. Like, I do believe that too much too soon is like, you know, cause a lot of these guys play to be professional. And then once they are professional, and not only professional, but like they're you know, everyone is, it's just so much happens when you have that level of stardom, you know? And I've seen it firsthand with Freddie, that like, it can kill your career. It really can. I think that they have to be managed. Like you have to be introduced to things and then taken away, you know? You have to create that. Even if the kid is unbelievable and they are in the starting 11, they should be their best 11 on the team. Even in those situations, just so you can get the most out of them and they get the most out of their career, you almost have to just show them a little bit and then take it away. Show them a little bit, take it away, and then eventually, because you know, I think it's like everything in life. Like you got to hold on to it the longest. You got to appreciate it. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that's a big problem with like our national team. You know what I mean? Like a lot of these guys, if they're healthy, they can call in no matter what. Right. So what does that do? You know, what does that do? So it's like, do they really appreciate these call ups? You know, I know we have to create stars. We have to get, you know, for marketability and to get people to come to these games, and we got to have faces of the team and stuff like that. But I think a lot of times we pick these young guys and like, I think we ruin their potential because they've been given everything so early that like it takes a special person to like get all that stuff and keep showing up every day to push your hardest and keep improving. And so, like I said, every player is different. You come from different backgrounds. You have different motivation to want to be a soccer player. But let's be honest, like a lot of motivation for a lot of the, especially these young kids that, you know, don't have families or anyone to really support, you know, like a lot of their motivation is just like to be a professional soccer player and have that stardom. And once they get it, like, it's hard to like, you know, you got it, you know, it's like you've achieved it. And so what's going to keep you pushing to now get even better every single year? It's tricky.
100%. And I think right before I pass the mic, I think, you know, we saw that with this Gold Cup that we just had this past summer, you know. You know, some guys opted out not to, you know, join the team this summer. But then, like you said, you know, similar to your story, we saw some guys get their first call up. We saw some guys that we've never seen on the national team before, you know, really get to have their moment. And, you know, I feel like just similar to you, there are certain guys on this national team on this past tournament that really took their opportunity and, you know, made the most of it with this Gold Cup. And, you know, I completely agree exactly with, you know, all the sentiments that you just said. You know, it kind of breeds something different when you really do. I'm not saying that guys don't take pride in their call-ups, but like you said, we've seen the players that, you know, I know I'm going to get called up, so I'm, you know, I'm not tripping. I'm going to chill and go walk into camp and this and the third, compared to the guys who, you know, this is their first call-up, but they've been waiting for this call-up for the past 10 years of their career, and they're hungry. You know, they really want that call-up. So, no, I just want to say I really resonate with that and agree with that statement as well.
Yeah, and I don't blame them. You know what I mean? Like, because I've been there. Like, I played there were a couple of years in a row. There's one season I played every single minute except for three. I was on a yellow card and coach took me out. But we at that time we played, we went deep.
I've been pissed.
Yeah, right. But I didn't know at the time that I was going to do that. It was like earlier in the season.
Oh, and okay.
So all of our season, all the MLS season, we had qualified for. At DC, we played a lot of the international tournaments. So I think we were in champions, CONCACAF Champions League that year. We did a deep run in Open Cup as well. In every single game of the whole season. And like after I did that, and then the next year it was like almost the same thing. Mm-hmm. And like after those 2 years, like I was spent, you know. So I don't blame them. Like if you know you're gonna get called in, and like you know you got kind of a, you know, your spot to go to the World Cup, like I'd probably take the rest too, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's one of those situations, like and this is kind of on the other end of the spectrum, but like never ask the player if they can play. I don't know if you guys ever heard that.
Yeah. 100%.
Because they're always going to say they can. So like guys will play through, you know, injuries and stuff like that, right? So like, and that's the other end of that. But like, they have to be managed. You gotta manage every single player. And like, yeah, these guys got to be managed. Like the team needs to be managed to where you're creating an atmosphere and a situation where, you know, there's a national team game. I'm going. You know, this is a highlight of my career. I'm going to be there. The federation has to create a atmosphere where, you know, that's the case. Like, you know, you look at some of the games now and like the stadium's like half full.
Yeah.
And with the new ticket prices and stuff like that. But like, I don't blame the players.
That's interesting, man. I actually, before Mike, you go, I saw an article today about Lucy Bronze. She's an outside back for the England women's national team. Mm-hmm. She actually came into this tournament with like she had like a I don't know what the exact thing was. I'm blanking on it now, but she had a big knee injury that mm-hmm. in hindsight probably she shouldn't have probably played through. And the person I was listening to at the time was like, you know, at what cost is it like worth it? You know, because now, I mean, they just won the Euros. So I guess
it was worth it.
Right. But, you know, now it's like coming out that she's probably going to be out like for a while just because, you know, she probably shouldn't have been playing on it. And, you know, at what cost is, you know, is all this? Because like you said, if you ask a player, like they're going to say, yeah, they're not going to say no, especially not for the national team and where she was, I guess, in, you know, the stage of the tournament. But no, that was,
yeah. It's tricky. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I don't know if you had anything more to say.
You can go ahead. I was just saying that.
Okay, so I want to go back a little bit. You touched briefly on your kidney condition. Mm-hmm. And what most fans might not know is you also had a turf toe injury, mm-hmm. Which can be a career-altering injury and in your career. So along having a kidney condition and then you have this turf toe injury, how did it affect you during that time? And did you think it affected your performances moving on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the end of it, to be honest. So I think it was twofold. The turf toe was a thing, but my kidney function at that time was getting down to below 30%. So this is my last season in MLS. Ended up being my last season. Oh, and what I was going to say to the what I was going to comment was, like, you never know when you're – because this ties into this. You never know when your last game's going to be, you know? Mm-hmm. So these national team players, you never know when the last time you get called up. I think about some guys now that used to be like kind of regulars in the national team, and now they don't. They're not even, you know, they don't get called up to the national team. You just never know, you know. But my last season, you know, I wasn't planning on that being my last season. My function was getting lower, but I was still managing. But when the way the kidneys work, they filter all the toxins out. You know, of your blood, yeah. And it releases it into your urine, right? And so when my function was going down, toxins were staying in. So whenever I had an injury, now it's taking me like that much longer to recover. Mm-hmm. Or when I was sore from training or a game, it took me that much longer to recover. And so I think with the turf toe, it just like, it just would not recover. It just would not. We do all the treatment. I get better. And I train for like a day. I feel pretty good. The next day, boom, again, right back to square one. And it would just swell up, flare up, swell up. And that was the last half of my last season, 2013. That was the pattern. And it was just awful. And the writing was on the wall. Like, I'm not even reliable, you know, to the coaching staff, and like they can't really count on me to, you know, to be consistent at that time. And we had a meeting at the end of the season, and my time with Revolution was done. I was going to go play one more season out in San Jose, but I just woke up and this was the off season, and my toe was hurting so bad, and I think I was traveling that day to fly to DC. And I remember I just like in the airport, I remember where I was and I just I called at the time my ex-girlfriend, who we were still very close. And I told her, I said, I think I'm done. And I told her and talked to her about it. And then I called my agent right after and told him, I think, you know, I'm done. And, you know, the craziest thing about it is when right after that phone call, I didn't feel my toe anymore. To this day, I haven't felt my toe since then. It was wild. I don't know if it's stress that was just built up or my body just finally was able to relax, but it was, ever since that day.
That is actually kind of an interesting story right there. Mm-hmm. Ever since you made that decision, have you had second thoughts?
There was a time, because I was also confused when my toe started feeling better, and I didn't feel. And granted, I wasn't training or like, you know, accelerating or pushing off or anything. Mm-hmm. And there was a day where I was like, I should go, like, you know, see if I can train with the team or something. And after that day, I was all set. I had played soccer my whole life at that point. Yeah. And at the time, I think I was 32, 33. Yeah. And so that was the first time I could, like, and I wasn't training for in the off season or anything like that. And that was the first time I realized that you didn't have to wake up and be sore anymore. You know what I mean? Like, because my kidney function was getting so low at that time, I used to train, be perfectly fine, wake up in the morning and something would be wrong, couldn't even walk, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I'd go into the stadium and we'd do some treatment and I'd end up being able to train, but like just the craziest stuff started happening as I was getting older and my function was getting lower, and it was just mentally, it was just too much. It was like, what, you know, what is going to be? I was like nervous to wake up the next day, you know, like, mm-hmm, worried about what was going on. And so when that went away, I was like, nah, I'm all set. And I hadn't really, besides that one day, I hadn't really had any, you know, I call some of the Revolution games. I do color, and I had a radio show with them, the local sports radio here. And we had a pregame, halftime show, and postgame. And so I spent a lot of time at the stadium talking to the players, seeing the players. Recently, this past season, I got to travel with the Revs to Kansas City and Montreal to call the game, and I traveled with the team, so that felt like I was like on the team. And let me tell you, the things that they have today compared to what we had, I sound like an old head right now. But I mean, with the private, you know, the planes. Not having to go through the airport, you know, literally, parking the car and walking straight on the plane. We had a flight at 10 o'clock out of Kansas City, and we didn't leave the hotel till 9. We just drove straight to the, and it was like a 40-minute drive, and we drove to the to the airport and just got off the bus, went on the plane, took off, and like the we got off the bus and I'm walking behind the team and they got radio going, and you could feel that brought me back. This was in Kansas City, and you could feel the energy And you can see I'm watching the players all day, you know, at pregame meal and like and all of that. And then but once they got off that bus to go through the tunnels to go to the locker room, it was like a shift. And they got music playing and like I was getting chills. It was something that brought back so many memories. And it was great because it was everything. Playing professional soccer and walking out, because back then DC was the place to play. We had the crowd, the whole stadium on that side. It was the stands that they were like weren't connected to the ground, so when the whole side is just shaking, just jumping up and down. You know, the smoke, the flying flags, everything. Like when you came out of that tunnel, there was no feeling. I don't know if you guys ever watched the Beckham doc. I'm sure you guys have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You remember when I don't know why I'm blanking on his name, but who's the right back that was in there a lot? What's his name?
Gary Neville.
Yep, Gary Neville. He talked about it. He's like, you know, a lot of us become like adrenaline junkies because there's nothing like going out on that field and having those people like you know, screaming and all the noise and just the way you feel on the field. It's wild. It's nuts. You know, I think back and I look back and just like, you know, how much faster I could run, how much higher I could jump in those games than I could even in training the next day because of adrenaline. And, and like, I remember when Seattle came into the league and they put DC crowd to shame with what they came with. And like the clapping thing when you're walking out, you got a long walk to the middle of the field for national anthems and intros, and they do this slow clap. And then as you get closer and closer, it gets faster and faster. And at the end, but when we line up, they're just like clapping, and it's the loudest, most just instantaneous. You just have chills the whole time. But you you feel like you really do feel like a superhero out there. At least I did. And it was something that I was so fortunate to experience. And like, you know, I think back to the beginning and like, I still don't know how I was fortunate enough to be able to, you know, coming from Jamestown, North Carolina, playing at East Carolina University and being able to do what I did. Very, very fortunate, very, very blessed to be able to do so.
Yeah. It's your story has been very, you know, inspirational. You know, you even sharing with us your kidney situation. What were some of the silent battles you were going through, and how did it shape you as a man today, the man that you are today, if you would like to share with us? That's my last question for you.
Yeah, battles in general. The amount of it's a stressful job. It's a stressful. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you, like, you know, you think about the games, but there's a period there out of my whole career. There were probably like 2 years where I felt like I was safe, meaning like I'm the starter. You know, this is my role. Like I had a high salary at that point. It felt like they couldn't even put me on the bench. But only maybe like two seasons. And I had a good amount of seasons as a starter. But on the front end of that, it's like trying to crack the lineup, you know, and you finally get it and you keep it. And then on the back end of that, you got young kids coming in every year, and these kids can play. They can play, you know. They still have a good amount to learn about the game and stuff like that, but they can play, and like it's just a matter of time, you know, at that point. So then it's just the stress to be able to have to get up every day and perform at that level is like, you know, and it beat me up. Like I was so concerned with it. Like I needed to be at my best every single day for me, and also to gain confidence through the week to take it into the weekend. That like I remember I used to get in arguments with one of my ex-girlfriends because I didn't want to walk around too much the day before, or I didn't want to eat. When you perform at that level, you can sense and you can feel everything.
You can feel your body.
Yeah. Oh my god! If I ate too much sodium, I was feeling it the next day. Mm-hmm. I better perform. If I was on my feet too much, I was a little more tired than I wanted to be, you know? And you know your body so well. And like, you got to perform. You got to be the best in training. You got to, you know, on Saturday, you got to perform. That was stressful. And I think one of the things, full disclosure, that I struggled with was just because everyone has coping devices, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of my coping devices were counterproductive, as far as, you know, maintaining and prolonging my career. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I had different habits or different coping mechanisms for that, or develop different things. But you know, and some of those things I deal with off and on, you know, to this day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, nothing too serious, but just just some habits that I have a therapist now, and because life is much different. Mm-hmm. The ex football player. Mm-hmm. And so but yeah, I mean, I also fortunate enough to take so many lessons. Like, you learn how to work with people playing at that level. I watch all my, you know, we run our own business now, and I watch all my managers and how they manage people. I learned more from the poor managers that I had than I did from the better, you know, the best managers I had. Learned more what not to do than what to do. And so very, very fortunate for that. The network that I gained, all my, you know, ex teammates and the people, you know, still be involved with the revolution to this day, is that part of it is great, is awesome. And like the brotherhood, that's you know, I feel I wish everyone could spend time in a locker room, no matter what level. Because I had friends that definitely had some certain views, and then coming into a team, and then you know, spending every day with guys from different countries, don't speak the same language, and you have the same goals and ambition, and now you're literally on the field trying to accomplish the same things. It changes you. It changes you as a person. And you know, I know they say the same thing about the military, but yeah, it's real. It's really like that. And yeah, I've been very, very fortunate.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. I really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I actually have just a few. We're almost done here. You've been very generous with your time. We appreciate you. Two more before we get into rapid fire. You were recently inducted in the North Carolina Soccer Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you, especially considering, I mean, your amazing journey?
Yeah, it means a lot. And so North Carolina was a little while ago. My high school one was last year. And so I got into East Carolina Sports Hall of Fame, North Carolina Soccer Hall of Fame, and then my high school Sports Hall of Fame. And I mean, it's awesome. It helps me to even better understand, you know, what I was able to accomplish. And those are things that nobody can take away from me, which is great. You know, even after I'm long gone, that stuff will remain. And you know, hopefully my legacy is a good one. I know I've been able to accomplish a lot of stuff to be proud of, and it's hard to see that sometimes, but so to be celebrated in that way is like, it's awesome. There's no other way to put it, really.
Okay. I appreciate that. Last question before we get into rapid fire.
All right.
So you opened up Rev Fitness. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on your expansion to DC. What inspired you to open that?
Yeah, so when I was done with soccer, there was two things. I knew I wanted to work for myself, and I knew that I needed to do something to keep that, like, team mentality. You know, I've been on teams my whole life, and I couldn't imagine just not being on one. So me and my business partner, that's what we try to create with Revved, and it's, you know, like-minded people just trying to better themselves physically and mentally. And obviously our staff, we work as a team. We try to manage everyone as if, you know, as if we're like a sports team. I learned a lot from managers. One of the biggest things that I learned was is watching some managers show favoritism, and which is really easy to do at that level, you know, because you have guys that everyone knows, you know, the game's going to run through them. Like, if they're healthy, they're going to play. They can get away with certain things that certain other players can't. But the coaches, the managers that could limit that stuff as much as possible, like, that's always when we had better teams, you know. And so we try to take all that stuff into what we do at Revved. But, yeah.
Sounds good. Yeah, we're gonna have to we gotta sign up for a class, guys.
Get this workout in.
I gotta come. We franchise now, and we had a we were talking to someone in Columbus. It didn't end up happening, but they might come back around. We'll see.
Okay. Sounds good. I got season coming up, guys. You gotta go. Group class.
We've been talking about that DC trip. Might have to actually.
I gravitated towards the bike because when I got older in my career, the last thing I want to do in the off season was more running and cutting. I just couldn't do it physically, and so I needed to get my cardio. And so I started taking spin classes at this gym in DC, and I just fell in love with it. At the time, we didn't even ride the rhythm; we were just like speeding up, slowing down. But the music and like the atmosphere, and we were going hard, and it was such a good workout. And then I wouldn't even be sore the next day. That, and then I realized every time we would come back from an injury, the first thing we would do is get on the bike. There'd be times where it would hurt to walk, but I get on the bike, didn't feel anything, and then I get back off the bike, then I'm hurting to walk again. So I realized that a lot of people can do the bike. They can't do other things. And so from a business model standpoint, it was like a no-brainer for me. Yeah.
No, absolutely. Absolutely, man. Great perspective. So just want to close out the episode with a few rapid-fire questions. You know, just quick answers, maybe a little bit of kind of insight behind them. So first one being, what's on your current playlist? You're a big music guy.
I teach spin. Okay. So it's a lot of EDM, to be honest. these days, a lot of EDM. Let's see. Some of my favorite DJs. One of my favorite DJs. Let's go with, I like LP Giobbe right now. LP Giobbe, female DJ.
Okay.
She's good. Check her out. Yeah.
Okay.
Check her out.
Toughest opponent and toughest team?
Great question. Toughest opponent. Is this all MLS? MLS?
Yeah.
Whole career. Career. Yeah. I heard Galacticos in there earlier.
Yeah. I didn't play much in that game, but I got to go toe-to-toe with Ronaldinho and Seedorf. I'm going to say the two of them together. And they were just like, you know, this was their off season. They were just on vacation. But these dudes, though, Seedorf was one of the strongest people I ever ever come up against. Just a rock. You couldn't move him at all. He just stand there. He didn't have to like get any leverage or anything. Just standing there, just a rock. But and Ronaldinho was getting towards the end of his career. They were at AC Milan together and played against them in the midfield. I would say that was probably the toughest. Opponent, toughest team. I'm gonna keep that with in MLS. I would say one of the toughest places to play was during my time was Seattle. And I think the biggest thing was the crowd, but they also started to develop a really good thing there for a while. I would say them or Salt Lake. Salt Lake had a spell where they were very difficult to play against, in Salt Lake, especially with the altitude. Those are a couple of places that were very, very hard to pick up points at all. Yeah.
Yeah, those Robbie Finley days.
Yeah.
One game you could relive. One moment. Yeah, it's up to you.
One moment. It was a loss and a playoff loss, but this one goal I scored against Chicago in the playoffs. Oh, yeah. It was probably one of the best goals I ever scored. I caught it off. The ball was bound. It was a tough touch from my teammate, but it was bouncing, and I caught it right off the half volley.
Yeah.
And I swear, I got to find – I don't know how I'm going to find it. It was an ESPN game, but I got to find it. They showed all the replays and stuff. Somebody made a GIF of it, and I found that, but, like, I can't find the goal or, like, the slow-mo replay. And I remember I think Ronaldo was calling the game, and he even said, you won't see – a much better goal than that. And he said anywhere, but the way it came off, and I swear it was probably a good like 7-8 yards outside the 18. And it didn't even, I don't even think it hit the ground, but it looked like it was on the ground the whole time, but it don't even hit the ground. And, yeah, it just went
a laser.
Yeah.
That's the grass cutter.
Thiago scored one. Like,
yep.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
It got sent in a group chat. Yeah, mm-hmm. It got sent in a group chat, and I was like, "Yo, I scored one like that." And like, this is all my buddies that played with here in New England, and they don't believe me.
we gotta find it for you.
We gotta get on film.
I sent the gift in the group.
No, absolutely. I remember that goal. Let's do this one. If you could create a five-a-side of your all-time teammates, who would they be? One goalkeeper and four players. You're the coach of this team.
Five-a-side. Wait, let me go back real quick. I got to change my moment real quick. I'm sorry. My cap against England. I got to make that. Okay. Yeah.
Who was on the field for England that day? Do you remember?
Let's see. It was a friendly. I remember, Alan Smith, Peter Crouch.
Wow, Crouchy.
I don't know if Rooney. I can't remember if Rooney was there briefly or not. If he got in or not. Joe Cole was on my side.
Damn.
Wait. So check this out. So they call the ball. My first like kind of action. The ball comes to Joe Cole, and he starts getting going right. And then and it's kind of not a one-on-one, but I had some help. And somebody called. They called offsides on somebody, and I'm like, okay. I'm like, I got out of that one. Yeah. I have to go back and look, but they had some players. They had some players there, but it wasn't their like all out team. But they definitely had players there. Yeah. Sure. Yep. So five aside plus a goalie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one keeper, four field players, and you're the coach of this team.
And I'm the coach. Four field players.
Mm-hmm. Four field players.
All right. I got Marcelo Gallardo. You guys remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He's got to be one. He was amazing. I'm going to say Emilio.
Wow.
Luciano Emilio, because I know he's going to score some goals.
Legend.
No way around it. I'm going to say let's see. Oh, this is a. I'm gonna say Benny Philhaber.
Okay.
Yep, Benny Philhaber.
Because that's three.
Yep, three, and then I need somebody in the back. I'm gonna put in. Bobby Boswell. Bobby Boswell on the back. Yep.
Okay.
And in goal, I gotta go with Nicky Raimondo.
Oh man,
Raimondo,
legend.
From one father to another, how has fatherhood shaped you as a man?
Father, So I got a son. He's 8, and he is a carbon copy of who I was when I was young. So I've learned so much about myself just watching him because. He just reminds me of so many different things, and also I get to see every when I have Gray, I get to see basically see myself at that age, and it's unbelievable. You know, a lot of times it reminds me of things that I've been through and how I've been shaped as a human, as a person, throughout the years. And like, I think I go into protection mode because I want him to be able to stay who he is. You know, I'm very observant now, having to watch out for, sure. You know, a kid, and he's good on his own now, but so many years when he's young, so very observant. And I've become a lot more present, to be honest. That's the best time of my week is spending time with my son. To be honest, like it's everything. Like he's great. He's like at an age where he's fun to be around. He's still a very happy kid, and I hope he stays that way. And I think he will. But you know, he makes jokes. He's funny, and so it just it gives me joy. It gives me joy, and it enables me to slow down, you know, and helps me to remember what's important for sure. So that's kind of how it's shaped me as a man.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good, man. Last question. If you were to give advice to any aspiring soccer players that want to go play in college or in the pros, what would you tell them?
Yeah, my answer's changed since I started training kids, because I see so many talented kids, super talented kids that just refuse to keep it simple, and I think they just lose it because they, instead of spending that time developing that that talent that they have and like just being a more able soccer player, there's a lot of time spent like, you know, doing things that don't matter, you know. So my advice is to really just get really, really good at the simple stuff, just learn how to be super consistent. I've been talking to a lot of my kids that I've seen grow up now, and now they're in high school and their bodies are changing, and now they're like adults and they need fuel and they need the fluids and all that stuff. They're not used to doing that. And now, you know, that's a big part of the game. My other advice is like there's a lot of other aspects to the game besides just being good with the ball. You know, fitness is huge in soccer. Being able to get around the pitch, because I've seen some of the most talented players growing up that after a while they just couldn't keep up, and that talent didn't mean nothing because they couldn't move around the pitch. So working on all that stuff, endurance, that speed and agility, is just as important as the footwork stuff. And I say watch a lot of soccer. What, when you watch it, pay attention to how simple the best players in the world, pay attention to how simple they play. Until they need to do something, they keep it really, really simple. And that's my biggest thing.
Right on, man. Yep. Good stuff. Well, as we close out, I just wanted to say, Clyde, thank you so much for your time. You're very generous with your time this evening. It's been a real pleasure to learn more about your story. For me, I've been following you for a while. Obviously, living in Columbus, I hated to see DC United.
Yeah.
So,
not DC.
I've turned my allegiances to Cincinnati, though, now.
Cincinnati. Traitor.
That's given Ohio for sure. But
yo, I had this argument. Well, I got you guys. Yeah. I had this argument with my buddies all the time about the importance of forming these rivalries that are close together, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we have this argument, and it might sound dumb, but we have this argument because I live here in Boston, and they talk about moving the Revs sometimes to the city, to Boston. And I have this wild idea that if they leave the Revs where they are and bring another team to the city, that it's just going to help soccer so much in this area. Because they love sports here, but they've never experienced having to pick between a team, and I think it's so
rivalry.
Yeah, and I think it's so special to me when you're having conversations with your neighbor, like arguments with your neighbor, versus everyone, let's all support this team here, mm-hmm. having, you know, or seeing if your team's red and other team's blue, but seeing so much blue all mm-hmm. over the city supporting this other team, like, I just think it just does something to the game in that area that is just like unmatched, you know.
I agree. I mean, I think it's only helped soccer in Ohio, definitely. And yeah. It helps that obviously Cincinnati is competitive. I mean, Columbus is one of the oldest teams in MLS. I mean, so is the Revolution. So I feel like I don't think we shouldn't touch them. Like, to your point, adding another team, creating that, you know, choice. Well, who do you want to support? And it could promote good competition there.
Yeah. And let me ask you, like none of the crowd, like the crowd in Columbus, it didn't suffer, right? If anything, it was better. Yeah.
It did. Yeah.
Like you look at the LA teams, like Galaxy, they still pull the same numbers, you know? Yeah. And now they got another team selling out as well. So that's.
Yeah. I mean, our crowd's better. So
don't do that.
it's only helped soccer in Ohio.
So. Yeah. So it was a wild idea I had.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey man, it may come to fruition. We'll see, man.
Yeah. One day.
One day.
They argue that Boston's not that big, but Boston's the same size as Manchester.
Right. So, wow.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Go ahead, fellas.
No. Just once again, just want to say thank you for your time. Obviously, like Salam said, man, we've been truly following your career for quite some time. And so just to be able to sit here with you, you know, just yap it up for an hour and a half about football, man, it's what we always love doing. And just be able to, you know, do it with you as well as it's been an honor. So, you know, thank you for the time and definitely appreciate you. And can't wait to see you. Can't wait to catch a spin class. That's what I'm
doing.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's nice to meet all. Yeah,
absolutely. I was just saying, just to piggyback what everybody else said, it's been a pleasure. And just hearing your story about resilience, too, I think anyone mm-hmm. who's out there who may be battling anything, you know, as a young athlete who may not know what is on the other side, I think hearing your story will give them a lot of, you know, inspiration to continue doing what they do.
I appreciate it.
My question for you is, what's their story behind the pro? Because that was a signature look for you.
A story behind what?
The fro, the hairstyle.
The fro.
Oh, the fro. Oh. Nah, that was my thing. You know, my son's mother won't let him grow his hair out, right? And then, and I'm like, okay, my dad did the same thing. So, and when Greg gets older, he's going to want to wear his hair long because he never did. Yeah. And that was the same with me. Like, I think once I got out of the house, I wasn't rebelling or anything like that. I think it was just like subconsciously, like I just needed mm-hmm. to have my hair long. And then it came in handy because, you know, guys, it helped me to not get, I mean, I think to protect me from concussions for sure. Because I had it on the sides and everything. And it was thick. definitely protective. After a while, that's what I like to tell people too. But my I see old pictures and stuff like that. Sometimes I wish I was shaped up for like for other reasons. But yeah, that was me at that time. Yeah.
Thank you once again, man. It's a true honor to have you on. Appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you again.